Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, campaigners from the Philippines, Latin America and England will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences that are too often missed by mainstream media. What's land got to do with human rights? How Indigenous leaders in Parliament are doing it different? And why the cocaine leaf is good for your health? I'm Chris Richards, and I'm joined today by my friend and colleague, Vanessa Baird, who, like me, is a co-editor of New Internationalist magazine. Vanessa's just been producing a magazine looking at new and brighter horizons now dawning for the 350 million Indigenous people across the globe. It's a nice change. In country after country, Indigenous peoples are often the most deprived. More likely to be in prison. More likely to die earlier. More likely to be hungry. Stripped of their land by foreign invaders generations ago, often with deadly consequences, community after community still struggles for a place within their own homeland. Usually amongst the poorest sections in society, alcoholism and domestic abuse often plague their homes and their hearts. You know the tale well. But the storyline is changing as Indigenous peoples become more organised, demand justice and fight back. 2.5 years ago, Indigenous leader Evo Morales was elected president of Bolivia. Vanessa's just been to that country. Are Bolivia's Indigenous peoples getting a better deal now that they have an Indigenous president, Vanessa?
Yes, I would say they are. One of the key points on which Evo Morales was brought to power was that the people, and particularly the social movements, which are made up largely of Indigenous people, were demanding nationalization of the oil and gas fields. And that's one of the first things that he did. Up to that point, what had happened was that previous governments and local elites had conjured all these sweetheart deals with multinational companies, whereby the companies only had to pay something like 18% royalties to the state for extracting oil and gas. That was increased to 82%. And in spite of that hike and that renegotiation of contracts, none of the companies actually left. So you can see how much money they were making before and continue making.
That's incredibly significant, isn't it, that they haven't left. So they've obviously been able to make a profit out of it and pay people in Bolivia properly for the resources that they're taking out of their ground.
That's right. And one of the results of that is that for the first time last year, Bolivia actually had a fiscal surplus. Now, what the government have been doing with that surplus is redistributing a fair bit of it towards the people. And it's taken the form of a collection of what might seem quite small social benefits, but when you count them all up, the cumulative effect is actually pretty good for the poorer people, of which Indigenous people are the majority. I mean, I think perhaps I should mention at this point that Bolivia is unusual in that around 60% of its population self-identify as being of Indigenous origin. So that does make quite a big difference to the whole sort of political and cultural landscape. These various measures included a universal old age pension, literacy classes in poorer areas, a grant for each child attending school, and free healthcare for children. And these were universal, they weren't just for Indigenous people, but because Indigenous people had been so disadvantaged up to then, the proportional benefit was that much greater for them.
Absolutely. And that comes out of the oil and the gas monies, the royalties that
yes.
were being... Wow, that's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, it is absolutely. These are things which are earmarked to come from oil and gas. They're also a specific percentage earmarked for Indigenous development projects, which is again from the oil and gas revenues. So when Evo Morales says to the people, it's your oil and gas. He means it. It is going back to the people. But another thing which is making a big difference is the redistribution of land. The government passed a land redistribution agrarian reform bill in August of last year, and up to now 500,000 hectares has been redistributed, particularly in the eastern part of the country, where land distribution is particularly unfair and where there have been situations with massive, massive estates as large as a small country, and even some places where indigenous people were held captive and had been for generations held captive on estates and forced to work on them.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about land later in the program, Vanessa, but just going back quickly to the oil and gas royalties, it's a very good advertisement for leaders in any country which have natural resources like Bolivia to stand up and say, well, actually, you've got to pay properly for the resources you're taking now. Do you think that there will be that knock-on effect? And I'm wondering, too, what reaction internationally has come the other way, whether or not there's been any kickbacks adverse to Bolivia as a consequence of it.
Well, many people, and certainly the people who were spokespeople in the hydrocarbons industry in Bolivia, were saying, whenever Morales was threatening to do this, well, the multinationals, they'll just leave. Bolivia doesn't have the capacity to exploit its own resources, and therefore it's going to be terrible for the economy. Not one left. I think in terms of the knock-on effects, a very interesting place to watch is just over the border in Ecuador, where Rafael Correa, who identifies as indigenous president, is coming up with a proposal that the international community pay the country in order to keep some of its oil in the ground rather than exploiting it. And the reason for doing that is to save parts of the rainforest and to cause less environmental degradation. Let's hope. But there might well be a knock-on effect in terms of pro-indigenous leaders combining indigenous rights, environmentalism, and getting a fair deal for their populations.
Well, for indigenous peoples, having a head of state doesn't just offer the possibility of a fair share of the country's money and resources, even though that's incredibly significant. There's something far more symbolic. Javier Albo is a Bolivian anthropologist. He's just dropped in for a chat from the capital of Bolivia, La Paz. Javier, you've been working with indigenous people for their greater inclusion in Bolivia's political and social life. When Evo Morales was elected president, what were Bolivia's indigenous people hoping for?
The moon, everything. They wanted everything. And of course, everything is not possible. But I think that the most important point that has happened after this is that they realize that they have dignity, that they can express themselves, that they are in different areas of power, that they can speak outspokenly and so on. This is the main thing. The economical thing comes behind. Dignity certainly is there. And perhaps one of the main expressions of this was the Constitutional Assembly that was elected 6 months after Evo took power. Indigenous representation there was very high and was again elected democratically.
I'd like to explore this concept of dignity and what impact it has on people. And I'm thinking that it must be reflected now in all kinds of ways. For instance, Javier, are you finding that Indigenous people are more likely now to stand up to the plate and participate in their own governance? And I'm thinking at a community level, in their workplaces, and even in their homes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is correct. As a matter of fact, one of the main things that happened immediately came before Evo came to power in the municipal elections. There were already many indigenous people who came to be part of the city councils, municipality councils, and quite a few of them were even mayors and so on. Once Evo came to power in the parliament, you see a lot of them. I will give you an anecdote that is very nice. In Sucre, where this main assembly was called to begin to discuss the new constitution, there were ladies with their Indian dress sitting down at the street, and the police came to them, please get away from here because the assembly constituents have to march. And these ladies walked up and came to the middle of the street because they were the new constituents.
Yes, I like that story very much.
In one thing that there is a lot of discussion at the present time is acknowledgement of their territories. In Bolivia are called indigenous territories or also tierras comunitarias de origen. This was a name that was given before. In the new constitution, it is said that this is acknowledged not only as an access to land, but also as one of the units of the territorial organization of the state. However, at the same time, this is perhaps one of the main points of polarization between the huge land owners in the lower parts of the country and indigenous people. So a fight, a strong fight that is going on.
I'd like to bring Vanessa Baird into our conversation now, Javier. Vanessa, you've just been to Bolivia. Leaving the situation with resources, oil and gas, to one side, it's a great example, though, isn't it? And I'm wondering if there's more examples like it of the president and his government using their influence and power to make decisions that are more in the public interest and less siding with transnational corporations. Now, that's a significant shift away from the normal way in which the capitalist global economy operates. And I'm wondering whether or not you see other examples like that, where there is a propensity for the president to put the public interest before the interests of capitalism.
Yes, I would say that there is. I don't think you would see, for example, today, the situation that we saw in Cochabamba, you know, a few years ago, where they attempted to privatise water and the government was obviously siding with the multinational corporations in that case. I think it's extremely unlikely that you would get that now. So I think there are examples. If you look at, for example, what's happening with timber concessions, in the past, timber concessions were handed out to multinational corporations quite readily by previous governments and previous local governments. But the government is not so happy to do that now and is paying much more attention to indigenous claims to territories and the need to protect the rainforests. So I think there are many ways in which the current government, attentive to the needs of the people rather than capital. I don't know. What do you think, Javier?
Yes. I think that it's very important to distinguish between the western highland areas and the lowlands in the eastern and northern part of Bolivia. In the first ones, the majority of indigenous population is so outstanding. You will have many of the places that have 80-90% of mainly indigenous people. They have to be the people who decide, because they are the high majority, even in the main cities like La Paz. So in that side of the country, there's no doubt, and it's the obvious thing that is happening. In the eastern and lowland parts of the country, that are about two-thirds of the whole surface, but only one-third of the whole population, in these places, indigenous are a minority. Always the minority within the population of these places. It is more difficult for them to be able to get improvement, especially because of this land distribution, because in all these areas, most of the land is on the hands of landowners, in many cases without legal papers, but they are still there. And in this second part of the country, it's more difficult to get whatever they are looking for.
Numbers are obviously important, Javier. I'm wondering about the culture of Bolivia, whether or not this time of change means that what has been the dominant culture will be the dominant culture no more. Is it, for instance, forging a more pluralistic society, more welcoming of indigenous views and wisdom?
This happens in the whole country, highlands and also lowlands. A few years ago, it was almost impossible to talk about interculturality. Non-indigenous people in power felt that being intercultural was a business for indigenous, because they have to be civilized, they have to be assimilated, and therefore they have to be open to interculturality, meaning that they have to become something like cultural mestizos. They have to get more from those who are civilized, who are Western-like in the cultural sense of the word, and so on. At the present time, everybody in the country feels that Bolivia has to be a country that is pluricultural, multi-ethnic, and therefore that everything has to be intercultural. This is not a success, I think. Nobody would be ready to deny this, all these developments that happened in the last years. Mm. However, there is another point that is a strong issue, a lot of discussions on that. Indigenous people and the government of Evo Morales and the new constitution that has finished but is not approved and has a lot of problems to be approved in the final issue, especially of these lowland people. They claim that Bolivia is a unitarian state, just one Bolivia, not a federal state, but with quality that they call plurinational, in the sense that all these indigenous people like to call themselves nations, in a way similar to what happens in northern countries sometimes, that they say the first nations. Here they also say we are nations, we are peoples, in spite of the addition that they are part of a unitarian state called Bolivia. We indigenous people want to be recognized as something that's very important for us, and therefore we call these nations. So we are plurinational within this unitarian Bolivian nation state. These from time to time say, oh, this is terrible, this will be the end of the United Bolivian nation. And this is a lot of theoretical and practical discussions up to now.
That was Javier Albo, a Bolivian anthropologist who is working with indigenous people for their greater inclusion in Bolivia's political and social life. Really fascinating insight, Javier, one we don't often see outside of Latin America. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
This final thing that I was mentioning, I think that fits with the fact that you are the new internationalist in all the places of the world. And keep proclaiming good news.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Junto a un cañaveral, una guajirita mía. Junto a un cañaveral, una guajirita mía. Soñando me decía, no me canso de llorar. Qué lindos son los palmares de mi Cuba bendecida. El extranjero la admira, qué bonitos sus paisajes. Arrogantes sus palmares y sus ríos
listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. And today, we're talking with Vanessa Baird about the rise of Indigenous rights, particularly in Bolivia, where Indigenous leader Evo Morales is now president. And if you'd like a copy of the magazine Vanessa wrote while she was in Bolivia, just go to the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Subscribe now and you'll get three copies of the magazine free of charge. Vanessa, time to bring out the biggest bone of contention for Indigenous communities, the right to their land. Historically, yes. What's happened to Indigenous land rights in Bolivia?
Well, historically, there has been some land reform which took place in the 1950s, but it only went so far. It didn't go to the east of the country, where up until very recently, there's been huge estates the size of a small country owned by just a few people. And those people tend to be the white settler oligarchs who run the show in that part of the country. It was the usual story. They would have called themselves pioneers. Some of them came from Eastern Europe. Some of them came from Spain. From the Middle East, you had German Mennonites. People from all over the place, really. More recently, you've had Brazilians who have settled there, and there's quite a lot of land there, which they see as ripe for exploitation. But there are also a large number, something like 36 different indigenous groups living in that area, who have seen their land and their territories whittled away over the years So there's a paradox that you've got a lot of land in that area, but there's also quite a high level of landlessness as well.
So how much access to land do Indigenous Bolivians have?
Well, this is changing. Up until really quite recently, you had a situation where there were even communities of Indigenous people who were slaves on estates. Mm. Estates would be bought and sold with Indigenous people on them to work them.
Wow.
With the new government, they have kicked into action land reform proposals, which have been around for some time, but they've done that very quickly and very effectively. A new law was passed in August 2007, and already more than 500,000 hectares has been transferred from landowners who, in the eyes of the government, are either not using the land properly or have got far too much of it. The land has gone to both Indigenous people from the region, but also there are quite a lot of Indigenous people who have settled in the region because of poverty in the highlands.
I'm wondering, too, how the non-Indigenous population are reacting to this. I can imagine that there would be quite a strong reaction there.
There has been a strong reaction in the eastern part of the country. We're talking about the Amazon region, and the elite in that part of the country, particularly centred at the town of Santa Cruz, they are trying to claim autonomy. They say they're not trying to split off from Bolivia, but it looks very much to everyone else as if they are trying to keep things the way they were in terms of being able to exploit the land for their own benefit, both the timber resources but also the oil and gas resources.
So is this about giving land to Indigenous people, as in giving them the ownership of land, or is it about the government retaining ownership of the land and giving Indigenous people access?
It's more about collective ownership, really. I think when land is handed over to Indigenous people, it's handed over to communities, and it becomes then part of their territory. It is a proper transfer of ownership.
Gee, there'd be some challenging issues there in terms of management then if the land was actually being managed by a community. Is it too early to be telling how that process will work out, Vanessa?
Yes, I think it's far too early. I mean, at the moment, you need to bear in mind that a lot of the Indigenous communities which are benefiting from this are very determined to keep their culture, are very determined to protect their environment.
Mm.
And so there is a high level of consciousness there. The things that they are battling against are the use of land for soya, for example, by large landowners, land clearances, also the environmental pollution caused by oil and gas exploration. This area of the Amazon is also rich in oil and gas. So those are their main concerns. There is a bit of a tension here, and I think it's something that we may see a lot more of, in that the government, obviously, and the state is quite reliant on oil and gas revenues. I think that we've seen that there are benefits to everybody in sharing the oil wealth, but this as a form of development is hugely destructive of the environment, and particularly the fragile Amazonian environments in which a lot of Indigenous people live.
Then there'll be two competing sets of interest there, won't there? The need for the money and the need to preserve the land.
That's exactly it. And the way in which the government tries to deal with it is that, okay, the land above the surface is one thing, but everything that is below the surface belongs to the state.
Wow, that's a pretty controversial way of dealing with it.
Yeah.
That means that the state might in fact be in competition with the interests of Indigenous people on those types of issues.
I think that's going to happen. So there are already tensions and there will probably be more of them. What the Indigenous people are doing are just trying to organise themselves to make sure that where there is oil and gas exploration, that they are properly consulted. They say that things have got better since Evo Morales came to power, but there's still a long way to go and it's still not nearly good enough. And they see the exploitation of minerals and oil and gas in their areas being really very negative for them. So I think that that's going to be an ongoing problem for the government and for Bolivia itself, dealing with this paradox, while at the same time saying that Indigenous people are the guardians of the environment. Putting their money where their mouth is going to be quite difficult.
Santonino Barris Jr. has just dropped in for a chat. He's a researcher, writer and advocate for autonomous land movements around the world and is one of the founders of the international peasants movement La Via Campesina. Let's take a bit of a global snapshot of the importance of land rights, June. In your view, what's the connection between the right to land and other social, economic and political human rights? Just a small question.
Yeah, well, the most important starting point is the fact that 3/4 of the world's poor are rural poor, and that's a lot of people. Most of these rural poor depend on land for their livelihood. In many cases, the state has failed repeatedly to do its responsibility. The worst part of it is to even respect its own laws, to carry out its own laws, so that when people from below push for their land rights, then in most cases, paramilitary and private goons of landowners and companies and even the state would come in to suppress mobilization from below. And we see this in different forms. We see this from, for example, land occupiers in company-held land in Indonesia, where the state would bring in the police and military to break up and harass peasant occupiers. We see this in the Philippines in a different form, where landowners have their own private armies and they would just go and kill peasants, and impunity would just be the rule of the game. We see this in Brazil, where organized landlords also have their private armies, and the police would just stand by and look at how these people would kill land occupiers.
I was reading some of your materials today, and I'm struck by, for instance, one of the greatest causes of eviction from land at the moment is paramilitaries actually evacuating people from land. I mean, it's about death, isn't it? It's about arrest. It's about displacement in a country like Colombia. It's about having the greatest amount of displaced people in the world at the moment because of evacuation from land.
Of course, violencia in Colombia has continued. It has never abated. You know, and it has always been tied up to people asserting their rights to land and to their territory. I think a struggle for land rights cannot be reduced to a simple kind of transaction about economics of it, just like what mainstream institutions would like us to believe in. The mainstream view is to look at land from a very purely narrow economic point of view. Land only has an economic monetary value. Well, not for advocates of human rights approach or the people in communities themselves who tend to view land from a more multidimensional perspective, meaning land has an economic, social, political, cultural, even religious dimensions. This multidimensional character of land cannot be captured by the mainstream economic frameworks solely.
Yes, for instance, hunger. Hunger goes up when access to land comes down. I was interested to see that 80% of hungry people live in rural areas. In which countries are people from rural areas most excluded from land use and access?
I think Latin America and Asia are two continents, regions in the world today, where access to and control over land remains very skewed and unequal. But it doesn't mean that in Africa, this is not a problem. I'm just separating Africa because it has quite a distinct character. There are spots in Africa where a lot of people are excluded from their earlier enclosures that happened with white commercial settlers there, in Zimbabwe, in South Africa, parts of Namibia, for example. So you will see similar exclusions that we could see in Latin America and Asia. However, in many parts of Africa, the land question has a distinct character. In theory, public lands that can be open to everybody who would need it, but not everybody would be able to access it. In fact, actually, the authority that governs the access and the control over these lands are very problematic. They call it very insecure access to land.
So looking at giving the people most excluded from land better access to it, which countries, in your opinion, are doing it best?
That's kind of a difficult question. It's very
relative.
Because I think all cases at the moment where there are significant efforts to redistribute or distribute access or control over lands are themselves very problematic. But we can point out some countries where significant progress has been observed during the past few years, like Brazil. Brazil's relative progress is very much dependent upon the strength of social movements from below. South Africa is a big disappointment, despite a lot of earlier talks about possible land reform post in 1994, but less than 10% of what was promised was delivered after 14 years.
Wow.
When in fact they promised to complete it 100% in 10 years. In Indonesia, which is a very low profile, and Indonesia is a very particular case because 70% of agricultural lands are supposed to be public lands, state lands. But in fact, since 1998, there were very dramatic land occupation activities from the ground where actual land rights were secured for peasants, which are not very well known worldwide, but I think it benefited tens of thousands of poor peasants since 10 years ago.
Mm.
The Philippines was a surprise case. 20 years ago, in 1988, there were a lot of pessimism because the land reform law was a compromise law. But in the 1990s, it was more of an alliance between social movements from below and some modernizing and relatively autonomous state reformists from above that pushed for a positive implementation of the law, so that today 7 million hectares of land were distributed to about 3 million peasant households, which is relatively significant, still below what was expected, but not completely insignificant.
Sorry to interrupt you, June, but that is incredibly significant for the Philippines, isn't it? As I understood it, there was such a small handful of families that had access and ownership to the land of the Philippines.
Correct. And then these few families are very well connected to the national state.
Leaders.
many of these people, their lands remains being in this struggle for redistribution. So at the moment, about 50% of agricultural lands in the Philippines have been redistributed. But when the current president, Arroyo, came to power in 2001, all land reform efforts were frozen.
As you were talking about that, it reminded me how fragile this whole process is and how much it relies on leaders. I'm wondering what the situation is in the Philippines at the moment and what hope you see now for agrarian reform to be progressed, given the current leadership.
The situation now is very bad in the Philippines. Whatever modest but significant accomplishments in land redistribution we have achieved in the 1990s, I think a significant portion of that is being slowly eroded by means of continuing reconcentration of land back to other elites because of other policies like privatization and import liberalization, where recipients of previous land redistribution could not manage with their livelihoods, that they end up selling out their land rights, renting out their land rights, leasing their land rights here and there. And so while freezing further land redistribution and then introducing neoliberal agricultural policies, I think not only stops further reforms, it also reverses previous accomplishments in land reform. But again, this is not a monopoly of the Philippine case. I just came back from Brazil, from a two-week intensive fact-finding mission there on the impact of agrofuels expansion on land in Brazil. And one of the things that I found out is that a lot of land reform settlements who have difficulty making living and livelihoods from redistributed lands have started to lease out the awarded lands to sugarcane companies for agrofuels expansion. And from being land recipients and settlement members to become small family farms, they reverted back to being cane cutters. It's kind of a depressing situation. And
sorry, June, just to interrupt there, cane cutters, the significance being that was the province of the slave trade in Brazil, wasn't it?
That's
the significance
slave
there.
Slave workers, I was there for 2 weeks just talking with workers and the situation of the workers. Indeed, the situation is slave-like. People die of exhaustion, and it's just unbelievable that it happens today and in Brazil. And we talk a lot about agrofuels and greener fuel, but then people die producing those things.
What you've raised is pivotal. The World Bank has a model which is based on trade, open it to the market and it'll all kind of sort itself out. Unfortunately, the whole of the world, having heard that for so many generations, now has that sections of it, very substantial sections of it, have embedded in their culture. Can we move away from that understanding of having land, owning it just individually, and then trading in it and using that as, if you like, a speculation base for wealth in the future? It means a kind of transition of our cultural understanding of land and how we interact with it, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, the problem is that we only have very few hopeful cases like Bolivia, where the national government is more of a keen on looking at other alternatives than purely private transactions. But I think worldwide, it remains that the key challenge is to defeat, to challenge, to fight, to struggle against the mainstream thing, which remains very much pushing for privatizing what remains of the public lands. There are two very mainstream currents today about land. One is what we call the market-led agrarian reform, which was invented by the World Bank to deal with existing private property rights, which is a willing seller, willing buyer, real estate transaction. And that is the main policy instrument to deal with private lands. However, there is a different policy to deal with what remains of the public lands, which is basically the majority of lands in the world today remains public or state lands. And here, the main policy is what we call the formalization of land rights, which is basically inspired by the works of the Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto. Their argument is that rural poor are poor because their main asset, which is land, is a sleeping asset. It is a sleeping asset, it's a sleeping capital, because it has no private titles, which the poor can use as tradable instrument to secure capital. Investors from the outside would not want to invest in the rural economies because their investments are not secure without private titles to become collateral. So, meaning the advocacy should be to privatize what remains of public lands. That is the most important policy by the mainstream in Africa and in many different parts of the world. So that land registration, land formalization has kind of a double-edged possible impact. It can possibly benefit the poor, but it can also possibly benefit the elite. But in situations where inequality exists, formalization of land rights almost always lead to formalization of inequality. And to think that most countrysides today are marked by unequal relationships, pushing for formalization of land rights, in fact, would result in pushing for formalization of inequality. And that remains, I think, the biggest challenge today.
That was Santonino Barros Jr., a land reformer advocating internationally and teaching at the Institute of Social Studies in The Hague in the Netherlands. June, I know this is a very small window of opportunity for you to talk with us, and we were really pleased that you could do it today. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Bye.
Nice to meet
you.
Bye,
Chris.
Bye.
Good luck. Okay, bye-bye. Ni lo vendo ni lo cambio, te lo juro.
bongo bongo mi bongo bongo en quizá de maya che che.
That was Cuban band Sierra Maestra performing the title song on their CD Rumbero Soy, a passionate love song to the rumba and the party atmosphere that dances to its beat. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today we're talking with Vanessa Baird about the rise and rise of Indigenous rights in Bolivia since the presidential election of Indigenous leader Evo Morales. Right from the beginning of his presidential term, Evo Morales has copped the flak for giving sanction to the much maligned coca leaf, scrapping the US policy to get rid of it and placing it instead at centre stage by placing it in a little bowl on every seat at his presidential inauguration. Why does the United States want to get rid of the coca leaf, do you reckon, Vanessa?
There are various reasons for this. The most obvious one is that they associate the coca leaf with cocaine. Cocaine is a product of coca leaves after they've gone through a very, very complicated chemical process. And this association, this idea that the one is the other, is completely wrong. But anyway, it's become very, very fixed in the minds of the US and the UN as well. The other reason is, I think, because the Coca-Cola company gained a monopoly on the name Coca-Cola and actually uses coca in making Coca-Cola, though there is no cocaine in the coca that they're using.
Anymore,
no. And another reason is probably that the current situation suits pharmaceutical companies who do have license to use coca product. It possibly suits them better that the licenses for using that product are very limited, so that Indigenous people or that people in the South can't make these pharmaceuticals themselves and sell them with coca in it.
We're about to go to Jim Schultz in Bolivia, in Cochabamba, and we'll ask him about what he sees on the ground about the health impacts of the use of the coca leaf within Bolivia. But I'm wondering, in your rounds in Bolivia, what use did you see for the coca leaf in Bolivia at the moment?
There's a continuing cultural use. It forms a part of ceremonies, weddings, funerals, any kind of religious ceremony. If you think of the way that Catholics feel about wine, you know, the use of wine in Christian ceremonies, the coca leaf performs that kind of function, really. So banning it is a little bit like banning wine from the Vatican, from on the religious grounds anyway. It also has got something like three times as much calcium as milk. So it actually has a food value as well. People use it as poultices when they've got aching joints. They use it as a mild stimulant in much the same way as people use coffee. So it is deeply ingrained in the culture and has been for thousands of years.
Actually, I've just been told that Jim Schultz has dropped in from Cochabamba. Jim, you founded the Democracy Centre there. Jim, of course, being a friend of this program and is often on it. We've just been talking about the health effects of the coca leaf. What do you notice on the ground as being the health impacts of the use of coca leaf in Bolivia and Cochabamba at the moment?
Here's one that's really significant. There's some excellent research being done both here and in France about the use of coca as essentially the methadone equivalent for cocaine addiction.
Wow.
There's a really excellent Bolivian psychiatrist here, Jorge Hurtado, who's also the founder of the Coca Museum, which is in La Paz. It's a great museum. In any event, they have a really excellent website, which also has everything in English. And Dr. Hurtado has participated in a number of international studies, and he really has a very strong case to make that you can use the coca leaf as a way of treating cocaine. I mean, also, coca tea is excellent for altitude. It's excellent for stomach problems. And I'll tell you one anecdote that, to me, symbolizes the importance of it. I had a friend felon named Don Pio, who was a construction worker, built houses, an older man. And I remember once he told me, he said, boy, if I didn't have coca, I'd be so fat because I'd be running to the refrigerator all the time because it suppresses the appetite. And he died about a year and a half ago. And I remember we were all at his funeral and they were about to lower his coffin into the grave. And I realized that he didn't have any coca. And I told his family, I said, you guys forgot to put coca in his grave. They stopped at the funeral until somebody could find a bag of coca tossed down into his gravesite before they piled the dirt on top. That's the significance of coca in this culture. The fact is that coca has many thousands of years of history in this part of the world. It was originally an Inca sacrament, and it's very important to indigenous culture. It's used in rituals all over this country by indigenous groups.
Jim, you're advocating that the international community get real about its attitude to coca. What are you suggesting?
The most important thing, Chris, is that people understand and that policy reflect that the coca leaf and cocaine are not the same thing. They're no more the same thing than grapes and wine are the same thing, or potatoes and vodka. And unfortunately, current UN policy has a list of drugs that it considers to be banned in terms of international export. Heroin's on that list, cocaine is on the list, I believe marijuana is on that list. But the coca leaf is on that list, and it doesn't belong there. One product of that policy is that the UN just recently issued a recommendation to countries, including Bolivia and Peru, that it basically prohibit the use of coca tea or the chewing of coca leaves, which is just ridiculous. I mean, it would really be the equivalent of telling people in the United States or Australia or England that they need to stop having coffee in the morning.
So how do you use the leaf, Jim? How do you come across it?
Well, it's easy to buy here. I mean, it's not an illegal substance. You go to the marketplace here in the little village where I live in Tiquipaya. There's a woman who sells it. And you strip the leaf from the stems, and you can stick it in between your cheek and your gum and let it sit there. I drink coca tea almost every day, which is just boil some hot water and you throw some leaves in it. So it doesn't become cocaine until it goes through this very elaborate process involving kerosene and other chemicals. To put it in perspective, the United States Embassy serves coca tea to visitors in La Paz and recommends it to U.S. visitors because of its properties in terms of helping people fight altitude sickness in the higher elevations in Bolivia. If you walk into the Radisson Hotel, which is the fanciest hotel in the country, the five-star Radisson Hotel in La Paz, the first thing that you know, radical Radisson company will serve you when you walk in the door is coca tea. Before you even check in, they serve you a cup of coca tea in the lobby. So the fact that the coca leaf is being treated as if it has horns and a pitchfork in terms of UN policy is ridiculous. And it's really based on faulty research that was presented to the UN back around the time that television was invented in the early 1950s. The actual policy of the UN, it's the continuation of a ruling that was made in 1961 that was based on bad research done about the impact of the coca leaf on the body some 10 years before that. Now, there's plenty of people calling for the removal of the coca leaf from the list of banned substances. But the United States is a pretty significant blockade to that. Even though it serves coca tea at its own embassy in La Paz, it still believes that somehow if you make it easier for people to import the coca leaf to any country in the world, that suddenly it'll increase the amount of cocaine in the world. And that's just faulty logic.
Evo Morales made a stand very early on by actually putting on the seats at his inauguration as president small bowls with coca leaf in it. What is the situation in terms of the economics of Bolivia with the coca leaf? How important is it to farmers? And what is Evo Morales saying within the country about the importance of the coca leaf and keeping it growing?
Well, you have a real paradox with the coca leaf, because the fact is that my guess is it's about 50-50. About half the coca leaf crop in this country is probably grown for traditional use, for chewing, for coca tea, for that kind of thing. And probably half of it ends up in the illegal drug market. And that is a concern for a lot of people. And it's interesting, it's not actually going to the United States. to the extent that the coca leaf grown in Bolivia ends up in the illegal drug market, it's more Argentina and Brazil. But the United States seems to think that it has to be the global policeman to deal with it. Now, the Morales administration is arguing that what we ought to do is we ought to expand markets, make it possible for people to put these coca leaves to use for non-narcotic use, to allow, for example, international export so that it would use up some of that product that would otherwise go to the illegal market. And I think that's a reasonable policy. In terms of export, you can make toothpaste out of it, you can make wine out of it, you can make bread out of it, you can make soap out of it. I think there's virtually no market for those products. I just don't think coca toothpaste is going to catch on. Coca tea, on the other hand, I think has a huge potential market. It's commercially manufactured. It comes in tea bags, just like your tea does in England or Australia at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The Chinese government and the Bolivian government have been talking for years about a potential deal to export coca tea to China. And foreigners who come here really love it. So I think it has a potentially huge market in places like the United States. Coca tea is the issue that they ought to push politically because it just underscores the irrationality of the policy as a symbol. But anybody who tells you that all of the coca grown in Bolivia is for benign use is also not being honest. What the Morales administration doesn't want to do is he doesn't want to go back to the time of forced eradication in which you sent soldiers in and started burning people's crops and provoked a lot of violence and conflict here in Bolivia.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, as you mentioned, the United States is the global policeman on this. It's actually aiding troops in Colombia, aiding police officers in Afghanistan to destroy crops of potentially drug-inducing products. I'm wondering what Morales is saying about the legitimacy or morality of the United States being in that role.
Well, it's not just Morales. Many, many people who follow and are involved in the issue of coca in Bolivia or elsewhere in Latin America are concerned about the role the United States has. I mean, look, let's just put it this way. The U.S. has been fighting a quote-unquote war on drugs in Latin America for over 2 decades. It's put thousands of innocent people in jail in Bolivia. It used to be that the prosecutors in this country were paid by the U.S. Embassy, and you can bet that they were increasing the numbers of innocent people in jail just to get their bonuses every month. And despite all of that, despite all the violence, despite all the economic damage and all of that, the fact is that it hasn't affected at all the price or availability of cocaine in the United States. By any measure, that's a failure. And so the United States needs to get real in terms of its own policy. Look, you have three choices. If you have a dollar to spend to fight drugs, and you can either spend it on trying to burn crops in countries where it's grown, like Bolivia or Colombia, or you can spend it on trying to keep them coming in at the border, or you can spend it to provide treatment on demand in the country where the problem exists, study after study after study says that where you really have an impact is if you spend that dollar on treatment on demand. And that's not what the United States does. The United States instead is spending those dollars on eradication in Latin American countries or trying to stop them at the border. And so it's just foolish policy, and it's based on ideology instead of logic, which unfortunately is the way a lot of U.S. foreign policy has been done in the last 10 years.
Yes. Jim, on a completely different topic, I understand congratulations are in order that the Democracy Center launched a book last week, Dignity and Defiance, Stories from Bolivia's Challenge to Globalization. Tell us a bit about its primary thrust.
Well, we're very excited about this book. This is something we've been working on for almost 2 years. The book is made up of 8 stories about Bolivia's experience with globalization, ranging from the famous water revolt against the Bechtel Corporation to the issue of control of gas and oil to migration of thousands and thousands of Bolivians to coca as well as a chapter. And the idea is that this is a book that goes beyond all the theory and ideology and rhetoric in this globalization debate and just ask the question, what does it actually mean, globalization, on the ground in a developing country? The book that came out last week is the Spanish version. We're very proud that the Spanish version came out before the English version, which is the reverse of what usually happens. English readers will have to wait till later in the year when the UK edition and then the United States edition will come out, and I'm sure that one or both of those will make its way to Australia as well.
Terrific, Jim. I'll look out for it. That was Jim Schultz from the Democracy Centre in Cochabamba, Bolivia. The book that he and his colleagues are just releasing is called Dignity and Defiance, Stories from Bolivia's Challenge to Globalisation. As usual, your anecdotes bring a colour to this program that's just delightful. Thank you very much for giving us your time this morning. When your book is launched in English, let's talk further about it.
That'd be great.
Okay, good to speak with you.
And Vanessa Beard, it's time to say hasta luego to you too. Just listening to you today, I feel I've actually taken a trip to Bolivia. Vanessa's recently written a magazine for New Internationalist about Indigenous rights, focusing particularly on Bolivia. Visit the New Internationalist website if you'd like a copy, www.newint.org. And what's your next magazine going to be?
I think it's going to be on the Yasuni Project, which is very interesting and in a similar part of the world, Ecuador. A proposal to leave the oil in the ground and for the international community to pay up to compensate Ecuador for doing so.
Do drop in again soon when you want to, Vanessa, and talk further with us about that.
Hasta luego, Chris.
The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Record series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Today's CD is called Rumbero Soy by those sons of son music, Sierra Maestra, singing about the beauty of both their homeland, Cuba, and their dance of choice, the rumba. Don't you just love that trumpet? Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find a copy of this program just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. And iPodders, if you want to subscribe to the program, the New Internationalist website's where it's at. That address again, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. This program's associate producer is Rachel Marr. I'm Chris Richards. Speak to you again soon.